You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 2nd of June 2023 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up.
I think defence departments should be talking to each other on a routine basis, or should have open channels for communication.
Can the Shangri-La dialogue achieve anything now that the US and China won't be talking to each other? Also coming up, OPEC bans journalists from its meeting in Vienna. What could it possibly not want us to know about? We'll be in Zurich for today's paper review. Florian Egli is scanning the front pages for us. Good morning, Florian. What have you spotted?
Good morning from a sunny Zurich. So we'll talk about economies in transition, so about the supply chain law in the European Parliament and about a deal that Tesla has signed with Ford. And we'll also talk about the general state of the news with local backyard flea markets making the headlines of the largest Swiss newspaper.
I can't wait. Guy Delaunay will also tell us what's making headlines in the Balkans.
Shenanigans in Serb parts of Kosovo continue, protests persist in Serbia, and Croatia wants you. All coming up in the Balkans Roundup with me, Guy Delaunay.
All that plus why, instead of steak, not too long ago, America almost found itself ordering hippo. We'll find out why. That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. So a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. The US Senate has passed a bill to suspend America's debt ceiling until January 2025. It allows the government to resume borrowing money and avoid an imminent sovereign debt default. The foreign ministers of the so-called BRICS group have called for a rebalancing of the global order away from the West. Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa make up the group, seen as an alternative to the G7. And British Airways has been fined $1.1 million by the US government over claims it failed to pay refunds for cancelled flights during the pandemic. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, tensions between the US, China, Taiwan and the war in Ukraine. Competing priorities for this weekend's Shangri-La defence dialogue in Singapore. The event is already off to a bad start, with China saying no to a bilateral discussion between their and the US defence chiefs. Well, I'm joined now by Scott Lucas, adjunct professor at the Clinton Institute, University College Dublin, and a regular voice. A very good morning to you, Scott. Welcome back to Monocle Radio.
That's great to be here, Emma. Thank you.
So just briefly, remind us of the purpose of Shangri-La. Who's there? It's sort of Asia's answer to the Munich Security Conference, isn't it?
That's absolutely right, Emma, except it's not just Asian countries that are there as well. It's some countries from outside the region, notably the United States. And in all total, almost 50 countries will be represented at the two-day meetings. I think what's important that you've already raised is that while a lot of the headlines will focus on the U.S. and China, including China rebuffing this effort by the U.S. for a bilateral meeting, you know, the fact is you've got a lot of other players who are at the table. And that means two things. First is it means that those other countries have a voice. They have an influence in regional security matters, and China will want to negotiate with them. And indeed, the line today in the Chinese press is very much on the line that China will be looking for cooperation. They'll be looking for progress at the Shangri-La summit, to the point where they said, look, if the U.S. really wants to talk to us, this is where they can do it. And then secondly, what I think it means is that the U.S. and China, although they will not have the headline bilateral open meeting between their defense ministers, you still have contacts behind the scenes that take place that do not make headlines. And those private channels, as well as, again, messages sent through third parties, will be important at this meeting this week.
There's a couple of things we can deal with there. Let's first touch on that expression that you picked up on from the Chinese press, which is China wants to cooperate and progress with other countries. Who is it targeting here?
First and foremost, it's going to start with Asian countries, of course, because, you know, that's the regional backyard for the Chinese. It's the fundamental part of what is now a well-developed Belt and Road Initiative. effectively an alternative Chinese system, but it's not just Asian countries, because again, with other countries who are represented there from beyond the region, and also through the messaging from this, China is reaching out in terms of a global, especially a global economic push, as well as security. So I think you also mentioned that this meeting is taking place at the same time that there is another BRICS summit. Now, BRICS is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. This time it's the foreign ministers are meeting, and China will be using that to say, look, you know, we are now a world presence. We are a world presence who doesn't want to pursue this for the sake of confrontation. Now, there is confrontation out there. Can we discuss it? But China's message will be very much on the lines of, look, you can expand in terms of your trade, your investment, in terms of your security position by working with us rather than by trying to stand against us.
You say that this is a meeting very much, as far as I can tell, dominated by China and what it wants to do. But what we have mentioned is the unusual nature of this summit, insofar as it is one of the few places on Earth where the US and the China tend to be in the same room.
It is, Emma. But now, again, I'm going to throw you a curveball by saying that I don't think we should say that China is dominating this. I think what I should have said is China is one side of this, and that the other side of this dialogue is not the Americans, or at least it's not just the Americans. There are a number of regional issues, for example, that will not make headlines, I think, in the US and the European press in the next 48 hours. And that's, for example, that despite China's wish to appear to be cooperative and to progress, a number of the parties in Shangri-La have immediate local issues with the Chinese. China's been very aggressive in trying to expand its maritime presence, trying to claim waters as its own that are actually claimed by or that are used by fishing boats, for example, from countries like the Philippines, South Korea, and Japan. Those countries don't like that. A number of those countries are worried about China's attempt to expand its control of the South China Sea. And while China continues to tout its economic cooperation, other countries in the region, not just the U.S., are concerned, for example, about Chinese industrial, technological, and economic espionage, and also about China trying to tilt the economic rules of the game at times where it isn't necessarily a win-win relationship, but one where most of the benefits accrue to Beijing.
There will be no Russian government delegates at Shangri-La. How does that change things?
It changes things a little bit for the Russians. And again, this sort of puts a different spin on the idea of just simply a direct U.S.-Chinese confrontation. Especially since February. So I'd say for 3 months, the Chinese have repositioned themselves over the Russian invasion of Ukraine. In February, the Americans made it very clear that Chinese military aid to Ukraine was a red line. Importantly, I think possibly even more importantly, the Europeans said, look, if the Chinese got too close to Russia over Ukraine, it would jeopardize economic links or the possibility of economic links, including a huge investment deal, which has been negotiated for years. And the Chinese have since then adopted a, I wouldn't quite call it a neutral position, but definitely a middle position. Not only have they not supplied military aid to the Russians, they have launched their own initiative to put Kyiv and Moscow on the same level, using the same two words, strategic relationship for both. And I think that is one reason why we're not going to see the U.S.-Chinese confrontation escalate to unmanageable levels, because I think the Chinese do not want to alienate the Europeans. The Chinese see a renewed relationship with Europe being essential if it is going to achieve its economic and political ambitions.
Scott, while we have you here, let's touch upon the debt ceiling issue over in the United States. The Senate's now passed a bill to suspend the debt ceiling until January, I think it's 2025. The Financial Times is sort of breathing an enormous sigh of relief in an op-ed today, saying, compared with what could have happened, it was close to being the least bad outcome possible. Would you agree with that?
At least as an outcome, because let's talk about what Trumpist and hard right Republicans were trying to do since January. They were trying to take the U.S. government down effectively. If you do not lift the debt ceiling, you cannot pay your bills. If you cannot pay your bills, you cannot finance yourself as a government. If you cannot finance yourself as a government, your international standing, your international, let's put it this way, credit rating is damaged. And there were a group of Republicans who really didn't care about that. Now, where did we get to with this deal? There are elements of it, individual elements of it, that I'm not happy with and that some Democrats are not happy with. For example, the Mountain Valley Pipeline, which has been approved for West Virginia, which just happens to be where an important Democratic Senator, Joe Manchin, is. I'm not happy with the fact that they have tried to curb some areas of domestic spending that are essential. I'm not happy that the Republicans have taken the spotlight off the biggest contributor to the debt, which is the 2017 tax giveaway to the richest Americans. But the fact of the matter is that a deal is better than no deal at all. And I think the adults in the room have prevailed. And importantly, one of the most important adults, I think Joe Biden, comes away with this with, again, showing that whatever you think about the white noise in the U.S., he can get politics done in the States.
Indeed. I mean, it's been described as a clean bill and how Joe Biden is serially underestimated. But also, let's talk about Kevin McCarthy, because you talked about the extremist members of the Republican Party who were trying to derail the government. He stopped that from happening.
Yeah, because Kevin McCarthy's made another flip. When Kevin McCarthy, who was desperate to get the House Speaker role back in January, cut serious deals, and I mean really deals that could have really been damaging, with a number of the hard right Republicans, putting them on key committees, saying that he would even pursue this challenge to the debt ceiling. It looked like that he was effectively the captive of the Trumpist. He's now wriggled free of that a bit. While there was a block of Republicans that tried to block this from going through, especially in the House, McCarthy's been able to tack back and work with the more sensible Republicans in the room. For example, the Republicans and the Problem Solvers bipartisan coalition. And that means that McCarthy now has the ability to maneuver. He's not in a hostage position. I do think he'll continue to make noise. He'll continue to try to appease the hard right Republicans. But I think you can now look at McCarthy as being a little bit more on the pragmatic side of politics here rather than on the red meat, fire breathing side.
Scott Lucas, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist.
What can you learn in a minute? More than you think if you subscribe to Monocle's daily email newsletter. The Monocle Minute provides fresh analysis of breaking news and direct-to-your-inbox insights on everything from global affairs to entrepreneurship. On Saturdays with the Weekend Edition, we'll widen your horizons with wry observation, drinking and dining recommendations and must-know openings. Subscribe now at monocle.com/minute.
It's 8:13 a.m. in Vienna, 7:13 a.m. here in London. Now, Reuters, Bloomberg, The Wall Street Journal, three bastions of solid financial journalism, trusted sources and globally recognised as such. But these three publications are among several to be banned by the global oil industry body OPEC from its meeting in Vienna this weekend. It's a strange decision, as the reporting of an OPEC meeting can lead to significant changes in oil prices around the world. Well, I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Tessa Szyszkowitz, who's a UK correspondent for the Austrian weekly magazine Falter. Tessa joins me here in the studio again. Hello, Tessa. Good morning.
Good morning.
So this is a strange affair, isn't it? Because some newspapers and some outlets are banned. Some, such as the Financial Times, aren't.
Yeah, I think we need to understand something about OPEC reporting. So this is a kind of oily affair. It's not necessarily as we're used to from other international organizations that everyone's invited and will report about things. Here, it's often the case that media that is being in favor of the Saudi princes, for example, is being invited and others are not. In this case, what sources told me yesterday is that Reuters was not invited because they although they report properly, of course, they had the Saudis thought they didn't like something they did report a while ago, and so they excluded them this time. But why Bloomberg and the others haven't been invited, we don't know exactly. But there seems to be a quite erratic attempt by the Saudi princes to think of cutting the production more, while others in OPEC are not with them on this, like the Iraq and the Emirates. So they're just trying to not have too much reporting before the meeting on the weekend, so I guess.
So at the moment, there's an unclear idea of what's happening in the meeting, but it doesn't seem to be a stable situation inside OPEC.
Yeah, I mean, the FT, who reported on it extensively yesterday, and not a lot of other media, mainstream media, has reported more. It seems that the Saudis are sort of have backed themselves a little bit into a corner because they would like to cut production and bring up the price, maybe connected to the very ambitious reform program in Saudi Arabia internally, that they need more cash. But to be honest, this is really a little bit opaque, these OPEC ongoings. And it's often known that reporters have to chase OPEC ministers or participants in the lobbies of Vienna's luxury hotels, hanging out, sleeping over in the lobby to wait until somebody comes back from a late dinner and get some information out of them. There's not, you know, they don't operate with press releases like we're used to from the European Commission.
And what you say here seems to be that the issues regarding who's in, who's out, has all been instigated by Saudi Arabia.
Well, that's the suggestion. Of course, there are always various camps, and it's all super sensitive, because it always has to do also that on the one hand you have OPEC, then you have OPEC Plus. So on Sunday there's a meeting with Russia. There's always the question, you know, what to do in this very, very, very sensitive oil market at the moment, due to the fact that there's, on top of all other intransparent, corrupt, sensitive, important world financial markets influencing issues that go around oil production and OPEC in general. We have a war. And so anything that leaks too early or is not organized in a very sort of proper way can send the financial markets into a frenzy. So I think people are at the moment a little bit upset with this beginning of this meeting here on the weekend in Vienna, because it just can influence too much, and the Saudi operation seems to be not very well organized this time.
Tell us a little bit more about how Vienna feels about being home to OPEC. It was originally supposed to be in Switzerland, but the Swiss said no. And now Vienna finds itself playing host to a body which, you know, many people say it is effectively an anti-competitive cartel.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is that, as you know, Vienna is home to international organizations. Some are maybe closer to the diplomatic, you know, world in a transparent way. So you have the UN also being in Vienna with one of the so-called outlets. But then you have OPEC. And in general, I think Vienna always has felt quite well about this, because it calls itself a neutral country, so you can house whoever you want. It has its downsides, it has its shady parts, as we know. And some of these princes that roll in with a lot of cash are very good for the five-star hotels. But in general, it's also quite good maybe if OPEC is in Vienna, because it sits sort of in the center of Europe and people can come together there on the so-called neutral ground. I mean, the question is, the sort of public in Austria, for example, this story has not been reported yesterday in the news or anywhere. I mean, people are busy with EU laws, regulations, how to support Ukraine or not against Russia and all these kind of things. So it's not a general news item what happens in OPEC. So it maybe feeds into this whole feeling of that there's some intransparent things going on.
I wonder whether, given the nature, you're just talking about cost of living, war in Ukraine, etc., and that's what's preoccupying the Viennese, whether the OPEC story will float a little bit more to the surface in the future.
Well, it's always the question also how sort of such important matters like oil productions and how it influences world markets is being organized. And that is definitely an issue that should be addressed, but will definitely not be addressed by the Austrian government, who is just too small to punch in this league with big oil-producing countries.
Tessa Shishkovitz, thank you so much for joining me in the studio. Still to come on today's programme.
Mud, mud, glorious mud. Nothing quite like it for cooling the blood.
We find out how the US almost became a nation of hippo ranchers. This is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
London. No, I'm telling you a lie, ladies and gentlemen. It's 8:21 in Zurich, which is where we're heading to now to have a look at today's newspapers. I'm dreaming, Florian Egli, of being in Dufourstrasse 90. This is clearly my problem this morning. Good morning. And I'm dreaming for good reason, aren't I? Because you said at the beginning of the programme that it is a lovely day by the Zurich Zoo.
Lovely, Emma. You're mentally here. That's great. No, it's a beautiful morning here. The only problem is my voice is about 7 pitches lower because I have a hay fever. So it's pollen season, but it's sunny and, you know, the lake is here, so everything is ready for a dip. So it's perfect.
And that sounds wonderful. And thank you so much for braving the allergies. Florian Egli, of course, senior associate at Voraus, the Swiss foreign policy think tank. You've been going through the papers today. Is there anything of any great interest, or are we on one of those Fridays where it's a little bit hard work?
It's hard work. We'll start. You know, we have a couple of nice international stories, and then we'll have a couple of emblematic ones that show the hard work.
Okay, let's go for the geopolitical approach first.
So first, we're in Germany. So the Frankfurter Allgemeine, the FAZ, has an article today about the European Parliament passing a supply chain Transparency Act. And I think that's important or relevant for two reasons. One, so this is a law that will demand all companies registered in the EU with over 250 employees and revenues of over 40 million euros a year to actually know what's happening in their supply chain. So they must be able to assess, you know, all the suppliers throughout the globe in terms of their impact on the environment, in terms of potential uses of child labor, etc., etc. So it really places the responsibility of the entire product at the kind of final company. And I think that's a huge game changer in terms of where the incentives are, you know, to change practices in how large companies operate. So that's interesting for that part. And the other link that's interesting is Switzerland has voted on a very similar law about a year ago, and it was accepted by popular vote but rejected because the majority of regions said no. So it's essentially we don't have this law, but there was a campaign that you know, took about 5 years and kind of really was very present in the public discourse about, you know, what global companies, what responsibilities global companies have over their supply chain and over how they actually produce the goods and items that we purchase. So this is not set in stone yet. There's more steps to take, but I think it's interesting. And if it really comes in the EU, because the EU is of course a huge economic area, then this will have consequences for, I think, the global economy.
It's brilliant in principle, and of course one always hopes that regardless of the size of your company, you know your supply chain in and out, but we all know that that's not always as possible as we'd like it to be. But what's being mentioned in the Frankfurter Allgemeine is the problems that small companies will now face, being overwhelmed with the bureaucratic task of the chain.
Exactly. So there is, especially in Germany that has a large tradition of SMEs, there is a lot of criticism that these SMEs will not be able to cope with that bureaucratic reporting. But there is a counter argument that says, you know, even if it's only the larger companies that have to actually do this, and there are some regulations for financial companies as well, then the smaller, by consequence, will have to do it as well because they're a supplier of the large companies, right? So it's not so much about the cutoff. So essentially, I think the debate will be more about the implementation. So how this reporting should take place, and there are kind of two loopholes that are in the law. One is that you can basically prioritize according to risk, so you don't have to basically constantly be on top of all the suppliers, but you can actually have a risk ranking and only look at industries or sectors or countries where the risk is higher. And also, what is probably going to happen, because this is going to the Minister Council now, and so there's going to be a political consensus that has to be reached. And as it looks like, what the Frankfurter Allgemeine writes is that it's going to be what Germany already has, which is a safe harbor clause, and that means that a third party verification company can actually give the stamp to a company and that's enough. So there is most likely going to be a large industry of third party and other companies that assess company supply chains. And so it's, as always with these things, is do we create more bureaucracy or do we actually solve a problem? I think it's a step in the right direction, but the implementation in these things is really critical, so that it's not just additional bureaucracy, but it's actually changing something on the ground. And whether that's the case, that remains to be seen, really.
Let's move on to Tesla. It is opening its charging system to its rivals. Explain a little bit more about that, because if this is the case, obviously it will mean that lots more companies or lots more car manufacturers can sell their cars knowing that people will be able to charge them.
Exactly. So one of the big obstacles to the widespread adoption of electric vehicles so far was what we call range anxiety. So people being afraid that they're going to be stuck somewhere and the battery is empty and there's nowhere to charge. There's a gas station next door, but there's actually no supercharger to charge your battery. So then you're stuck. And if you want to go to a meeting or if you're on a holiday, that's not very nice. And Tesla has really addressed this quite well. So they have almost 20,000 superchargers, for example, across the US. In Europe as well, they have a pretty dense system, so that it's very likely that you can actually charge your car on the way as well if you ever have to. But that used to be exclusive, so only accessible for Tesla. And now the US has a large subsidy program, and one of the conditions to qualify for subsidies in building charging ports is that your system has to be accessible by other companies. And that's presumably the reason, that's also what the FT writes, that Tesla is now opening its system to Ford in a first step. And I think what we'll see is that these systems are going to open more and more. And actually, that's going to really push the adoption of EVs, because it's just going to basically take away that range anxiety, because the superchargers or the really fast charging ports are just going to be as ubiquitous as gas stations are today, and we're just going to see that system kind of rolling through and replacing combustion engine cars. Some minor problems remain, kind of funnily that, some cars you have to charge in front, others in the back, and there are some worries that the cables are not long enough, but I think all of that we should be able to overcome this in the coming months.
Finally, Florian, we're running out of time, but it's important to note that the front page of the Tages-Anzeiger, a Swiss paper of note, is concentrating on something which I adore, a flea market. What is the issue with flea markets in Switzerland, and why is it making headline news?
Backyard flea markets, we love them. So there is a specific day for every district of Zurich. There is 12 districts, and every district has its specific backyard flea market day. The first one is next Saturday. And what that means is you can register your backyard, and then you can basically just sell stuff that you want to get rid of. And it's really emblematic because it's really this kind of Zurich during summer, because we've done that actually several times as well in our backyard, and it's really much more about the getting together, sipping a glass of Prosecco, standing in the sun and trying to, you know, pretend a bit that you negotiate about the price, but you're just happy if people come and have a look and then take some of your used stuff. Actually, in some of the backyards you find really some bijoux, some very, very nice things, but it's really about getting together and sipping a glass of Prosecco. So that's going to start next Saturday, and it makes a headline, so first page of the Tagesanzeiger, which is a bit of a sign for the state of the news today.
Not just that, I would say getting our priorities right.
Indeed.
Florian Egli, thank you so much, and looking forward to seeing the results of your flea market escapades next week. You're listening to Monocle Radio. It's Emma Nelson here bringing you The Globalist Live. The time here in London is 7:30. A quick look now at the latest headlines. The US Senate has passed a bill to suspend America's debt ceiling until January 2025. It allows the government now to resume borrowing money and to avoid an imminent sovereign debt default. America's upper chamber voted 63-36 to approve the bill. It's now up to President Joe Biden to sign it into law. The foreign ministers of the so-called BRICS group have called for a rebalancing of the global order away from the West. Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa make up the group, seen as an alternative to the G7. Allegations of Russian war crimes in Ukraine have clouded talks in South Africa. British Airways has been fined $1.1 million by the US government over claims it failed to pay refunds for cancelled flights during the pandemic. The US Department of Transportation said it had received more than 1,200 complaints after the airline hadn't given timely refunds to passengers. And Chinese airlines are avoiding flying over Russian airspace in newly approved flights to and from the US. Previously approved Chinese airline US flights are still using Russian airspace. Russia has barred US airlines and other foreign carriers from flying over its airspace in retaliation for Washington banning Russian flights over the US. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. It's less than a week since Nigeria's President Bola Tinubu took office, but already he's been making some unpopular choices. In his inaugural speech, he announced an end to the country's fuel subsidy scheme, albeit in a manner suggesting his comment was rather off the cuff. But within hours, queues had formed at petrol pumps across the country as Nigerians rushed to fill their cars before prices rose any further. Well, to tell us more, joining me now is Nabila Usman, who's a journalist with Radio Now 95.3 FM in Lagos. Welcome, Nabila.
Hello, Emma. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you with us. Now, this end of the subsidy, it was expected, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. The previous administration had planned for it from the moment the petroleum industry bill was signed into law. This was in 2021. So essentially, when it was signed into law, subsidy became ended, illegal, if you like. But there was an amendment to the Finance Act to provide for it for a period of 12 months, so throughout the year 2022. Now, when that came to an end, they amended it once again to provide for subsidy for the first 6 months of 2023. So this is where we are now. Subsidy has been taken off. We've been expecting it, so it's not necessarily a new decision.
It's not a new decision. We've been expecting it, but it's still causing a shock. And more importantly, there isn't the infrastructure to help people come off the roads and take alternative forms of transport.
Quite right. We don't have a proper public transportation system in most states in the country. For context, there are 36 states and power issues. And as such, people supplement, they augment their power with generators that run on petrol. So this is going to affect productivity across the board. We expect to see price increases rippling across the entire economy, the first being transportation, which has gone up about 100% in a number of cities across the country.
Now, the background to this, the reason why Nigeria struggles with its fuel prices, it's quite astonishing, isn't it? It was the oil comes out of the ground in Nigeria, but it's refined in Europe and then has to be imported back, which costs the government a fortune.
Yes, indeed. I mean, for context, petrol subsidy started in the 70s. it was essentially regularized. It had a formal structure in about 1977, and it's been on since then. So there are generations of Nigerians who've never bought petrol at the actual cost of it, the true value. And our refineries here in the country, there are refineries in places like the two in the south-south, there's one in the northwest, and these are refineries that are owned by the government. They've not produced a lick of fuel. They've not refined a liter of fuel in decades, but they've been costing the government money to sort of just upkeep to some extent, because they need a turnaround maintenance to be able to provide refined fuel. And because of this, the country has continued to import at greater costs. For context, now that we've got oil subsidy removed, we're paying three times the amount. So the government has essentially been offsetting or subsidizing about two-thirds of the actual cost of petrol. So this is why it's such a shock for people. And over the years, we've been seeing slight increases as the government's ability to pay for a subsidy has been reducing. And everything really goes back to Nigeria's ability to raise revenue, because if you look at the budget for 2023, it comes to about 20 trillion naira. Of that amount, more than half of it is a deficit, money that we cannot actually gain. We can't pull from whatever our revenue generating sources are. And as such, it's being funded by borrowings. And we are getting to our end, to our limit in terms of borrowings. Right now, the public debt stock stands at about 77 trillion naira.
The issue here, and this is being widely reported, and you've touched on it just then, Nabila, there's criticism yesterday levels directly at Bola Tinubu and previous administrations. You are subsidising this stuff, said someone, but you are also the reason people can't afford it if it's not subsidised. So the government is a problem.
Yes. It's certainly a failure of successive or previous administrations. It's not just this administration, but perhaps more so the immediate past administration of President Muhammadu Buhari, because what we're seeing play out right now is the plans that they put in place. So when the President Tinubu announced the removal of subsidy, at best, really, what he was doing was a confirmation, because a lot of people thought a new administration would come and perhaps reverse the decision of the previous administration, which didn't end up happening. And yesterday, the group managing director of the company that's in charge of importing oil, the only company with that license in the country today, said that the government hasn't paid a single kobo of subsidy to it for the 6 months that it was provided for, which then forced their hand to actually increase these prices when the president confirmed that he would not be taking a decision to reverse that plan.
Nabila Usman, thank you so much for joining us on the line from Lagos. You're listening to Monocle Radio. This is The Globalist. Now, as it's Friday, it's time for Monocle's contributing editor Andrew Muller to share everything we've learned this week. I've got South
Carolina on my mind. We learned this week who the real villain is in the case of Russia's ongoing onslaught against Ukraine. We learned that it is not, as might be assumed, and as the International Criminal Court alleges, President Vladimir Putin of Russia. We learned that it is, in fact, and bear with us on this, the senior US senator from South Carolina. With those clean, snow-covered mountain winter times. This earnest, if not downright dreary, Glen Campbell pastiche is, we learned when we looked it up in search of an appropriate soundtrack, South Carolina's state song, South Carolina on My Mind, which works well in this context because South Carolina appears to be on the mind of Russian prosecutors. Yes, think we just about landed that one.
Love that one, Andrew.
Yeah, pretty good,
amazing,
actually.
Yeah.
Good choice.
Always good to have you on board, General Muttered Agreement crew. We learned that Russia had issued a warrant for the arrest of Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina after the senator had visited Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Kyiv and been rather dropped in the soup by his hosts, who released this video of the interaction.
Now you are free.
Yes.
And we will be.
And the Russians are dying.
It's the best money we've ever spent.
We learned that Russia had taken an amount of umbrage at the senator's apparent quote to the effect that Russians are dying, it's the best money we've ever spent. And to be honest, you can see how that would upset people. But we subsequently learned that this wasn't what Graham actually said, or at least not really. We learned from the unedited video that what Graham actually said was this.
We know that from first days we have total support. It's about 38 billion. Big support, very important.
The best money we've ever spent.
And then, somewhat later, this.
You remind me of our better selves in America. That there was a time in America that we were this way. Fighting to the last person. We're going to be free or die.
Free or die.
Free or die.
Now you're free.
Yes.
And we will be.
And the Russians are dying.
From all of which, we learned a couple of things. One, that a promising career in Ukrainian presidential political communications might have been abruptly rerouted to spud peeling duties in an especially unglamorous field kitchen. And two, that even when Russia doesn't have to do the deceptive editing themselves, they still massively oversell it to the extent that they get to tee up this snivelling nincompoop.
I'm sorry I'm so upset, but please help President Trump. If you can afford $5 or $10, if you can't afford $1, fine. Just pray. Make sure you vote as early as you can in your state. Don't risk anything anymore. Vote as soon as you can. Pray for this country. Pray for this president. And if you got any money to give, give it. LindseyGraham.com. It doesn't go to me. It goes to helping this president and taking back the Senate.
Four, and we are a credit where it's due, kind of sneering satirical monologue, an admittedly badass punchline, as will now be read by Monocle's admittedly badass punchlines desk chief, Christy O'Grady.
Here's an offer to my Russian friends who want to arrest and try me for calling out the Putin regime as being war criminals. I will submit to jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court if you do. Come and make your best case. See you in The Hague.
Elsewhere, we learn that something appears to be up with Wales. Wales, 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 as in the hefty placental marine mammals.
See the water squirting out of your spout.
We learned specifically that a pod of orcas off the coast of Spain had sunk a yacht. Like, for real, this is not one of those insurance claims that gets read out for laughs at the annual loss adjuster's Christmas dinner. Almost certainly very much like that, yes. And, yes, they're committing these acts of petulant piracy on purpose. We learned furthermore that this was not the first such incident. Indeed, this was at least the third orca-related sinking in the Straits of Gibraltar in the last few years, and that these dispatches to Davy Jones' locker were only the most dramatic of more than 100 attacks upon passing shipping by orcas in that vicinity in that time. We learned that the technique favoured by the orcas tends to focus on chewing off the boat's rudders. Come on, let's have something that sounds like orcas chewing off a rudder. Outstanding, and that more than a quarter of vessels thus victimized were so badly damaged that they required towing back to port. And we learned that according to the best guesses of whale boffins, the orcas are doing this for a laugh.
I'm in that camp of play as opposed to, say, an aggressive thing, because I believe, given, you know, what we know about killer whales in general, if they were really trying to take a boat down, they would be hitting it harder. They would be hitting it, in a more concerted effort. There seems to be a lot of interest in the rudder.
But we learned that the big weirdos were not done there. We learned that a Russian spy whale, a white beluga which has been delighting the producers of And Finally Spots for some years now, had resurfaced in the waters of Sweden. Suspicions of the creature's links to espionage go back to the first sighting of it a few years back, in which it was observed wearing a harness marked Equipment St. Petersburg. And it is, to be clear, actually a thing that the navies of Russia and the United States Greece, among others, have employed aquatic mammals for intelligence-gathering purposes, although it strikes us that the decision to employ four such surreptitious designs, a bright white one, may suggest that the handlers of this whale should have gathered some intelligence for themselves before going after anyone else's, but anyway. We learned that other whale boffins believe that this whale's motivations are more innocent, if not downright melancholy. It is believed that he is lonely.
Aww.
Not that he has any kind of license to krill.
Aww.
For Monocle Radio, I'm Andrew Muller.
Thank you, Andrew. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Let's head now to the Balkans for the latest from there, from Monocle's Balkans correspondent Guy Deloney. A very good morning to you, Guy.
Good morning, Emma.
Nice to have you on the programme. Now, let's just talk about what's happening in Kosovo, in North Kosovo. This is something that has started off locally, but has now got to the stage where there are serious talks had yesterday in Moldova with Kosovan and Serb leaders and the German Chancellor and the French President.
And the EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell. He'd be very upset that you forgot him there, Emma. But yes, they were all sitting down at a table together and having a natter. Well, it wasn't much of a natter, I suppose. They weren't really having, you know, hot bants about where they were going on summer holidays, I suppose. But they were talking about the situation in North Kosovo. And the very interesting thing is, if you look at the sort of narrative of the way these things go normally, it's usually fairly even-handed. Both sides get a slap or get a chivy or get a carrot dangled in front of them. Over the past week or so, we've seen international leaders more or less lining up to give Kosovo, and particularly Prime Minister Albin Kurti, a metaphorical slap across the chops. They're very unhappy with him, and they've said that it's all his fault for provoking tensions in North Kosovo by using armed police to force their way into municipal buildings and install ethnic Albanian mayors who were elected following a boycott by ethnic Serb voters who form the majority in North Kosovo. And at this meeting in Moldova yesterday, basically more demands from the international side of things, Macron, Scholz and Borrell, saying that they wanted elections, new elections in North Kosovo to actually elect mayors who do represent the local people. And furthermore, they want Kosovo to implement this very long-awaited association of majority Serb municipalities, which would be a device to give ethnic Serbs in Kosovo some degree of autonomy, the degree of which is, you know, highly debatable. But nonetheless, it's got to do something to establish this association because it's been, not doing it for the past 10 years. And Borrell said at the end of this, if you don't do it, there will be consequences for our relations. And, you know, just to prove this all has teeth, we've had Antony Blinken, Secretary of State of the United States, saying pretty much the same sort of thing, and then barring Kosovo from taking part in a NATO exercise, which was happening on its own soil, just yanking them from the exercise without any more further ado.
Guy, just briefly explain the context of all this, because it's flared up and perhaps a bit of background needs to be explained.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we could go all the way back to 2008 when Kosovo unilaterally declared independence from Serbia, and Serbia, along with scores of other countries, still does not recognise that declaration of independence. And you've got in North Kosovo a large ethnic Serb minority who don't recognise the authority of the government in Pristina. Nonetheless, over the past 10 years, things have been changing ever so slightly, and there have been various agreements which have resulted in these municipalities in North Kosovo actually taking part in elections under the auspices of the Republic of Kosovo.
So this has been this ongoing sort of fudge or compromise that's been going through. But they boycotted these elections in April because of this failure of Kosovo to set up this association. So that's, you know, provoked all of this tension that's been happening over the past, really it's heightened over the past week, but it's been building up for quite some time.
Let's move on to a second story about the issue of Croatia. There is a huge labour shortage. We've mentioned in the past here on Monocle Radio the fact that the service industry is desperate for more people to go and work there, given the huge tourism industry there. There's now a call for more immigration.
Yeah, and the Croatian businesses, the Employers Association, the Chambers of Commerce, everybody in Croatia who's involved in business is really giving the government a hard time, saying that they have to streamline the process for work permits in Croatia because they're really struggling to get workers in. I mean, if we just start with the country's biggest sector, which is tourism, which is conservatively 20% of the GDP. And I think it's probably rather more than that these days because the sector's been going from strength to strength. They're short of tens of thousands of workers for the summer. And this is because local Croatian people who would normally do those sort of jobs either don't fancy it for the wages or, since Croatia joined the European Union, they're off doing that sort of work in other countries. So they're desperately trying to draw people in from other parts of former Yugoslavia, so from Serbia, Bosnia, North Macedonia, but also further afield, places like Nepal and the Philippines. And all of this needs processing. And the government's saying, well, you know, we have processed 50% more work permits this year than at the same time last year. But the employers are saying it's still not enough.
And it's that problem, isn't it? Because you've been in Croatia recently and one wonders how the, let's say, the hospitality industry, which is so important to Croatia, is actually surviving if it doesn't have enough staff. Because if you have a bad experience in Croatia, you're not going to come back.
And this is the thing, it's already getting a bit too busy. And there's people that I talk to within the hospitality industry in Croatia who say that, you know, perhaps the country's going about things the wrong way, that they're, you know, too much focusing on mass tourism and not being selective enough. I mean, I know somebody in Kvarner who runs a very nice restaurant there who says we should be promoting, you know, the real culinary experience of Croatia rather than setting up stands along the beach selling, you know, sausage and chips for people on cheap packages from Germany and Austria. So, you know, it raises those sort of questions. Instead of trying to import more and more workers to service more and more tourists, do you naturally have to get a bit more selective about the kind of tourism that you're offering? And if so, how do you do that?
Guy Delaunay, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. You were the Globalist. Now, the steakhouse is considered worldwide to be a quintessentially American thing, big beefy portions that suit a big beefy place. But imagine if that T-bone hadn't come from a bull, but from a hippopotamus. Well, this nearly happened 100 years ago. And the writer Shoshi Parks has looked into us. She joins me on the line now from San Jose in California. Hello, Shoshi. Good to have you on Monocle Radio.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So just to explain a little bit of a background to this. This emerged from a crisis when it came to a supply of cheap meat, wasn't it?
That's right. Yes. So around the turn of the 20th century in the United States, there was some access issues for low-cost meat that up until that point had always been available and had, in fact, become a hallmark of sort of the American dream, particularly for immigrants moving into the country from Europe. But around the turn of the century, suddenly that meat was no longer available, and people were very concerned about the fact that meat may no longer be something that could be eaten at all three meals of the day.
So they decided that the best answer to this problem was to breed hippopotamuses or hippopotami. I can't remember which one it is.
Yes, exactly. It was a solution that they believed would not only provide meat for, you know, low-cost meat for that could replace things like beef, for example, but it was also something that could solve another ongoing problem at the time, which was taking place in the South, in Louisiana and Florida, whose waterways were being overcome by an invasive plant called the water hyacinth. Supporters of this idea thought, well, not only could the hippos provide meat, but they could also eat the water hyacinth, therefore clearing those waterways as well, killing two birds with one stone.
Was there any indication as to how people would eat the hippos, as to what would be their method of cooking?
Well, we don't know for sure. Sure, but one of the sort of, I guess you could call it a meme going around at the time that was coined by the New York Times was lake cow bacon. So we're not exactly sure if that means they would have, you know, literally created bacon out of hippo flesh, or if they would have eaten it as steaks, probably a variety of different ways.
The whole thing nearly made it into law, didn't it? Because we had an individual, a representative from Louisiana called Robert Broussard, who actually introduced the American Hippo Bill to a House committee on agriculture in 1910. I mean, how close did we come to this?
Well, not too close. Unfortunately, it never got past the committee, or perhaps fortunately, I should say, it never got past the Committee on Agriculture, although this representative, Broussard, had intended to bring the bill back the following year, possibly making it all the way to a vote on Congress or in Congress. But it was, in fact, a legitimate bill where they were requesting a certain amount of money to bring not just the hippopotamus in, but actually up to 100 different species from Africa and Asia to populate what were then considered unused areas of the U.S. So, for example, the deserts of the Southwest, they believed, could be a new habitat for rhinoceros. And the Rocky Mountains could be a habitat for yak from Tibet to roam free.
One thing that perhaps they didn't factor in, which is unlike cattle, which are a pretty docile breed, hippopotamus is aren't.
That's right. Yeah, hippopotamus are actually very dangerous. And in fact, they're considered one of the most dangerous animals in the world. I believe the figure is they kill on average up to around 500 people a year. So these are not quiet, docile animals.
One thing you do have to ask is, had this gone through, and if we were to be living in 2023 and hippopotamus meat was something which was rather commonplace in the US, do you think it might have changed the US identity, or actually, given the fact that hippos are quite feisty creatures, that it would have made America even more bullish or even hippo-ish?
That's a really interesting question. Well, we know for certain it would have severely or significantly changed the ecological aspects of the United States. You know, it would have drastically change the environment. In terms of American identity, wow, that's fun to think about. Yeah, perhaps. Americans are often very proud of their meat eating. And I think, you know, being able to say that you're eating something like, a hippo or an elephant, I can definitely see many Americans, you know, taking pride in that behavior.
It would be a little bit more macho even than
exactly
eating a massive steak. But I mean, besides, seriously and finally, it the story that you tell is one of a nation which struggles with a dependence on cheap meat, which is something that we're talking about nowadays.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It's in many ways, it's not so different.
Shoshi Park, thank you so much for joining us on The Globalist. And if you are tucking into your breakfast right now, I do hope you're enjoying your lake cow bacon sandwich. Well, that's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to all my guests and to the producers Emma Searle, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Laura Kramer. Our researcher was Helmi Pillai and our studio manager was Tamsin Howard, with editing assistance from Mariella Bevan and Callum McLean. After the headlines, more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday here in London, and The Globalist is back at the same time on Monday. Hope you can join me for that. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.